Today's sermon is called Famous Last Words. And actually, it's very appropriate because today is the last Sunday before the summer holidays. And as Kerry said, it's also the final sermon in our series on King David. So I thought I'd begin with some examples of last words, some by people you may have heard of, some by people you may not, some by people who knew they were about to die, and some by people who didn't. Take, for example, the Australian wildlife expert and TV personality, Steve Irwin, who died in 2006 while filming a giant stingray. Speaking to the camera, he announced, "Don't worry, they usually don't swim backwards." Tragically, this is exactly what happened. This was what the stingray did. And his barbed tail stabbed Irwin in the heart. And he died very, very quickly after that. My next example is the actor, Sir Laurence Olivier, who died in 1989. Olivier's nurse was attempting to moisten his lips, but clearly missed by miles. Olivier, who was particularly known for the role Hamlet, retorted, "This isn't Hamlet, you know. It's not meant to go in the expletive deleted ear." I last read Hamlet many years ago at school, and I'd totally forgotten this detail, but apparently Hamlet's father was killed when poison was dripped into his ear while he was asleep. So clearly what the nurse had done when she was trying to moisten Olivier's mouth had somehow managed to pour water or whatever it was into his ear. I'm sure Olivier didn't know these were going to be his last words, or he might have said something different, but he slipped into a coma shortly afterwards and never spoke again. My final example is a story that has always moved me. In this case, the person concerned knew that these were his last words. This is Lawrence Oates. He was born locally in Putney. And he was a member of Scott's ill-fated 1912 Antarctic expedition. And on their return journey from the South Pole, having been beaten to the finish by the Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen, Scott's party faced horrendous weather conditions. They also struggled due to lack of provisions, injury, and ill health. Suffering from gangrene and frostbite, Oates knew he was compromising his companion's chances of survival. According to Scott's diary, Oates left his tent on the morning of his 32nd birthday, uttering the words, "I am just going outside. I may be some time." Sadly, his heroic gesture made no difference to the final outcome. Everyone perished before they could reach safety. Well, our reading began with, "These are the last words of David," 2 Samuel 23:1. But David's death doesn't actually occur until three chapters later in 1 Kings 2. So in what sense are these his last words, and why are they given such importance? Well, the clue is in the first verse, an oracle of David, the oracle of a man, of the man anointed by the Most High. And an oracle was a word that was directly inspired by God. In other words, what David is saying is that although I'm physically speaking to you, it's God who is speaking through me. David's words were God's words, and the word oracle is repeated twice to emphasize this. And we're also reminded that David had been anointed by God. In other words, he'd been chosen by God. He'd been set apart to rule over Israel. So David's speaking not just with his authority as king, his earthly authority as king, but with God's heavenly authority as King of Kings, which makes his words even more important. And in case we still haven't understood that these are God's inspired words, the next four lines of David's poem say the same thing. "The Spirit of the Lord spoke through me. His word was on my tongue. The God of Israel spoke. The Rock of Israel said to me." Moreover, this was David's last public speech. Not long afterwards, he withdrew to his private rooms where he later died. So what is David's final vision? Well, it's partly a summary of David's reign. It's a reflection of everything that he's achieved. But it's also prophetic in the sense that it looks forward as well as back. It's a description of God's ideal king. It's a vision of what David's descendants should aspire to. When one rules over people in righteousness, when he rules in the fear of God, he's like the light of morning at sunrise on a cloudless morning, like the brightness of rain after rain that brings grass from the earth. Righteousness is one of those words that has a multitude of meanings, but ultimately it's about justice, honour, integrity, and goodness. Ruling in the fear of God is not about being afraid of God, but about showing reverence to him, taking account of God's desire in whatever is done. The irony being, though, while saying this, that David was effectively judging himself. Because although outwardly David may have looked like an exemplary king, especially in contrast to the kings of the nations around him, David's inward and private life was pretty chaotic, pretty disastrous. Last Sunday, Dale spoke about David's affair with Bathsheba. David conspired to have Bathsheba's husband killed. There was nothing just, honourable, truthful, or good about that. And his actions had consequences which reverberated throughout his family. However, David did eventually acknowledge his fault before God, and God forgave him. And to be fair on David, he always behaved totally honourably towards his predecessor, King Saul, even though King Saul constantly tried to kill him. But perfect king David was not. At the same time, David clearly understood what a perfect king should be like. So David, the singer of songs, turns to poetry to convey the qualities that he so admired and which he struggled to imitate. He is like the light of morning at sunrise on a cloudless morning, like the brightness after rain that brings grass from the earth. And it's a picture. That's what he's doing through his words. It's a picture of God doing something new, God doing something perfect. Sunrise indicates the beginning of a new day. Moreover, it's a perfect day where there are no clouds in the sky. It's a world that has been washed clean like the brightness after rain. It's a world where new growth is beginning, rain that brings grass from the earth. These words are full of hope and promise. Wherever righteousness and reverence for God go hand in hand, the nations will flourish. But actually, the same thing is true in every situation, not just in the nations. When we're in our workplace, wherever righteousness and reverence go hand in hand, the atmosphere in the workplace will flourish. Wherever righteousness and reverence for God go hand in hand in our families, then our families will flourish. There's a sense that when these things mesh together in the right way, that it just enables God to do all sorts of amazing things. At the end of his song, David describes what happens when righteousness and reverence are absent. Evil men are like thorns. Anyone who goes near them gets hurt. Thorns cause pain and destruction. They need to be dealt with if the land is to become fertile and productive again. So 2 Samuel 23:6 and 7. But evil men are all to be cast aside like thorns, which are not gathered with the hand. Whoever touches thorns uses a tool of iron or the shaft of a spear. They're burned up where they lie. Once again, David doesn't see the irony of his words, because he too had been guilty of evil, causing pain and destruction to those who were near him. And the truth is, the kings who followed him would also be a mixture of good and bad, of righteousness and evil, because that's our human nature. Only one man would fulfill David's vision, Jesus, who was a descendant of David and the Son of God, the only truly righteous king. Isaiah says in chapter 11, the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the spirit of counsel and of might, the spirit of the knowledge and fear of the Lord, and he will delight in the fear of the Lord. Jesus delighted in doing the will of the Father. He delighted in pleasing the Father. He took account of the Father in everything that he did. With righteousness, he will judge the needy. With justice, he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. Righteousness will be his belt, and faithfulness the sash around his waist. Jesus was the fulfillment of David's words. He was both righteous and obedient to God. Wherever Jesus went, he brought light and hope. He offered life in all its fullness to anyone who was willing to receive it. And Jesus treated everyone alike, rich and poor. He treated everyone equally. At the same time, Jesus had a particular compassion for the weak and the vulnerable, because they were and still are generally ignored by society. So Jesus challenged those in authority, because many of them were dishonoring God by doing nothing to relieve their situation. He confronted the Pharisees and told them, "You have neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness." And as we look at today's society, it feels as if nothing much has changed. There's a huge divide between the wealthy and the poor, between those who hold power and those who do not. And I think it's rather appropriate that this picture of the Grenfell Tower has got the financial centre of the City of London in the background. And it's just the contrast between two completely different situations. And it's hard to contain it, really, the pain and the desolation that that picture of the tower represents. And it shouldn't have happened. It shouldn't have happened. And the rich will no doubt go on getting richer, and the powerful will no doubt go on getting powerful, and will no doubt not do what they're meant to do to prevent these situations happening. So what hope is there for us? Well, our hope rests in Christ, our perfect King, who gave up all the splendour of heaven to live among us, who chose a life of poverty and simplicity, sharing all that he had with those around him, who made no differentiation between rich or poor, friend or stranger, and who was willing to die for us to set us free from the power of sin and death. To the very end of his life, Jesus brought forgiveness, hope, and transformation. "Today you will be with me in paradise," he said to the thief on the cross. And that's Luke 23. 43. When Lawrence Oates stumbled out into the snow, it was the end. His friends never saw him again. But when Jesus died, it wasn't the end, because Jesus was raised from the dead. Death couldn't contain him. And he gave us this promise that those who believe in him, even though they die, will live. And whoever lives and believes in Jesus will never die. That's in John 11:25. That's our hope. Not only can Jesus transform our lives here and now, but he offers us the gift of life after death. Or as someone once put it, the gift of life after life. Earthly powers, earthly kingdoms come and go. Only Jesus' reign will last forever. And he's invited all of us to be part of his kingdom. And it's not about how good we are, it's about how great God is. I'll just pause a minute. Thank you, Ian, that's great. It's a bit disconcerting having that noise in the background. It's not about how good we are, it's about how great God is. If it was about our being good, the thief on the cross wouldn't have stood a chance. But Jesus invited him and said, if you want to be with me, you will be with me. He didn't say, oh, I'm really sorry, you know, your life's a mess. End of. He knew that the man hanging on the cross was sorry from the heart about what he'd done. He knew that the man on the cross recognized how good Jesus was, because he said to his companion, this man has done nothing wrong. And then he said, Father, you know, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And that was all that was needed, just to say the word sorry. And everything was put right. And David understood that. You know, he made a mess of his life, frankly, his personal life. But he knew that God loved him. He held on to that all the way through his life. He had a unique perspective on God. And I was thinking about this morning and just thinking that for most of the nations round about, the gods they worshipped were terrifying. You had to please them, you had to placate them, or they would do something terrible to you. It wasn't a relationship of love. But David loved God, and he knew that God loved him. And ultimately for David, that was enough. And David also understood that he was great because God had given him greatness. He wasn't great in his own strength. It wasn't because of anything David had done that he was in the position he was in. It was because God was great and God loved him. And if that's the legacy of David that we remember, that's the legacy that we need to remember. David asked God to forgive him when he had done something wrong. And what was wonderful about David was, once he'd been forgiven, he didn't go back and keep digging over old territory. He's forgiven for the sin that he committed against Uriah, and actually he is punished for it, because Uriah was Bathsheba's husband and David had him killed, and then he and Bathsheba went on to have a child, and that child actually dies, and David recognizes, he begs with God to heal the child, and God doesn't heal the child, and David recognizes that this is part of God's judgment on him for what he did. I don't want to focus on that, because the danger of that is, you know, we can take it and think every time a child dies, that's God's judgment on us, and that's not the case. But in David's case, it was. This child did not live, but David understood why. But he gets up and he rejoices, and the people who are around him are terrified. They think David's fasting and praying and he's begging God to let his child live. And they said, his child's died. What are we going to do if we come near to him? He's going to be angry and he might kill us for bringing him bad news. And actually they see David get up off the floor and he bathes himself as if to say, I've done my lying on the ground and covering myself with ash. That period is over. He stood up, he rejoiced, he asked for food. He was able to move on. He didn't allow guilt to hold on to him. He knew God had forgiven him. He knew God had released him to continue with his life. And I just feel that that's something for some people here who are held back by things that have happened in the past and who can't move on, and they keep remembering it. They keep going back and they keep going back and sort of stirring up the muck again and revisiting old arguments, constantly revisiting old hurts and stirring it up and then feeling it all again. And I think that God is saying to some people here, I don't want you to do that because it's destructive. I have forgiven you. I want you to move on. I want you to put that away, leave it behind, don't carry it around with you. I want to do something new, like that new, lovely, lovely picture of the new, fresh, green life after the rains, when the sun comes out. That's what God wants to do with some people. And the other thing I think God was telling me this morning when I woke up was, don't leave it too long to say the things you wish you could have said. I mean, it's a real, I know it sounds really strange, it's a real bonus if you know you're dying, because you have really good conversations with people. And that's what happened between us and our son, because we knew that he was dying and so did he. And we had some great conversations. But we don't always have that privilege of knowing when we're going to die. And even, you know, with our son, we didn't know the exact moment of his death, but we knew we were approaching it. And some people wait too late to put things right, and they don't say it. And I'd just like to share a story of me and my dad. I loved my dad. My dad loved me, but he was quite a complicated person, and he didn't always get things right. And our relationship wasn't all that it could have been, or all that it might have been. And in some cases, it was what it should not have been. But I loved him, and he loved me, and we knew that. And love covers a multitude of problems, doesn't it? When you love someone, you can put up with all sorts of things. But in his final week, I was so privileged, because I was there for his final week, and he knew he was dying. And during that week, he said two things to me. And actually, he said three. I'm telling a lie. He said three. And one of them was, I walked into his room and he said, "Do you know how beautiful you are?" And I just had tears rolling down my face, because my dad wasn't a great one for telling me anything like that. And I never believed I was beautiful, because I think one of the most important things that parents can tell their children is that they are beautiful. Because so much around us tells us that we're not. You know, you're too large, you're too tall, you're too this, you're too that, you're not enough this, you're not enough that. Anyway, my dad never really told me I was beautiful. And there were other factors as well, but I grew up thinking that I wasn't beautiful. And when he told me that, it's just overpoweringly amazing. You know, I still struggle with my image occasionally. My husband would say more than occasionally. He says, "I keep telling you you're beautiful and you don't believe me," and it's true. So he said that. The other thing, he looked at me and he said, "I'm really sorry for the things that I got wrong. I wasn't always a very good dad to you." And I was able to say to him, he said, "Will you forgive me?" And I was able to say to him, "I've already forgiven you. I forgave you a long time ago. You don't need to worry about it." And the other thing he said, my husband is completely different to all the lads I went out with before I met Joe, because I'm an extrovert and I used to go out with lots of loud extroverts, and actually it didn't work, because you had two extroverts clashing, and each wanting to be the sort of the number one, as it were, and wanting all the attention at the same time. It's not a good mix, actually. And so God in his wisdom paired me with an introvert. Joe is the polar opposite of me. We think completely differently. And he always says, "I'm a Hebrew because I think in stories and pictures and poetry and art and things." He's Greek. He's extremely factual and logical and whatever and whatever. So when we got together, my parents were a bit shocked, because he was so different to everybody I'd gone out with before. And they weren't sure that it would work, even though I said, "No, believe me, this is right, because we balance each other." And Joe was always left feeling slightly on the other foot whenever he went to visit them, because my parents were both extroverts. So, of course, they had this logical, quiet, often silent person in their midst, you know, and they wanted noise and communication and whatever. And Joe wasn't like that. Anyway, my dad, in his last week, the other thing he said was, "Joe has been very good to you. You were right. you have been very good for each other. He's been good for you and you've been good for him. And it occurred to me, what a difference it would have made if my dad had said to me throughout my growing up life, you are beautiful. If he had said to me earlier in his life, earlier in my life, would you forgive me for the things that I've got wrong? If he'd said to Joe and I a year or two after we got married and not waited until we'd been married for nearly 40 years, you two are so good for each other, we can see how good you are to each other. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Wouldn't that have been wonderful? Wouldn't that have been so healing for us and enabled us to move on in a really good way? So I'd just like to say, I just sense that some of you have got conversations that you need to have, where you need to seek forgiveness and reconciliation, or where you need to say things that should have been said a long time ago and you've not said it. And I appreciate that that's difficult, because sometimes if you've not said something and you know you should say it, it's really hard to do it and you think, how are they going to receive this? But believe me, if you ask God to help you and to give you the right time, he will give it to you and you will say it and there'll be so much blessing from it. And I just want to encourage you in that, because we were lucky. You know, David said what he said and it was a wonderful prophecy about Jesus. But supposing he hadn't said it, we wouldn't have it. And there's so much sometimes in our dealings with other people that we need to do to put things right. And then when we do that, we're actually walking in righteousness and reverence with God. And that's when we'll see God doing new things, God doing beautiful things in our lives. So I just want to pray as we finish. Father, thank you that you